our next speaker is Professor Elf Sol from the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, thank you, Evelyn, for inviting me to this beautiful city with such a large history, and also a history not only in architecture, but also in our field of research. And I feel it's a privilege to discuss the material I'm going to present here in this city right now. What I'm going to present is something with the title The Puzzle of Linking Performance and Steering Frontline Workers Through Welfare to Work Programs. And I'll explain a little bit to start with where exactly I came from and what I'm doing. When you look at evaluation research, in fact, you see two streams of research. You see the economist doing research on mainly impacts, and then there are other researchers that social scientists, psychologists, sociologists, who do implementation studies. And they do implementation studies, very informative ones, but it's not often that they link those implementation studies to output, the impact of studies. And what I intend to do with this study, it's a larger study, is to bridge that gap and present findings about which differences in implementation can be observed in the daily practice of frontline workers that cause variation in impacts. So the combi. What we see also amongst economists is new recent research where they are now in fact more interested in how to steer frontline workers, how to manage them in a way to get better output. And you could say that researchers are looking at it from different points of view. In fact, there are three entries for the analysis, which are related to the policy cycle. It is analysis which is linked to input, analysis which looks at the process, the throughput or with input, and evaluation research that is interested in the output. What we see is amongst economists that they do a lot of input analysis right now. Input analysis, like we have been discussing already earlier, profiling, targeting. So what they do is they use net effectiveness studies in order to come with systems of profiling and targeting whereby the discretionary room of the caseworker is diminished in a way that they think will bring a better output. There are also a lot of researchers, economists mainly, it's their domain, that do research on outputs. We came across already some of those instruments like pay for performance, bonuses, analysis like that. But the throughput, the with-input related to output hasn't been researched much. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is that in Europe, at least in Europe, I don't know, I hope to learn more about what's happening here in the US. But in Europe, we see amongst those same economists that they are not that much interested in the throughput studies. And there's been one study from some Swiss researchers which have made things worse. It's a study by Smith and Lechner, and they did a study to the value added of case workers. And it was a study whereby they tried to find the added value by case workers in allocating the unemployed to services, so as to maximize their subsequent employment prospects, and they compared them to randomly assigned services. And it's an older study. They used data from 1998, but the result of the study was that they really couldn't find any difference. So it didn't matter what the caseworkers exactly could or couldn't. If in effect, what they did was no better than what statistically was done divided. Sorry, my English is not that well. Okay, so this study is mentioned in, I think, every speech right now amongst economists saying, well, why talk about professionalization and discretionary room? We can see we can do it better by trying to canalize the input and the output. I think that's one reason. Another reason, I think, is that we do not have data available from the practice of frontline workers related to the outputs. And what we do right now is a research where we have done a survey amongst frontline workers in three countries, in the Netherlands, the UK, and in Australia. And we tried to get as much info as we can about the practice of frontline workers. What I will do in the 10 minutes I have got left is tell you about a part of that study. We just finished the surveys. They were by the end of 2008, and the latest were in January this year. And I will tell you about what was researched earlier, because it's a longitudinal study. We had a study done in 1998 amongst those same countries, and now, 10 years later, we repeat it. And what I'll do this afternoon is tell you a little bit about what were the results in 1998, and then go more into depth on the relationship between governance and output for the Netherlands. I use this framework, and it's a framework that tries to make a relationship between the governance and other implementation elements and output. And what I tried to do was to make some hypotheses. I'll just mention the hypothesis we used in this study to come to results, and later on I'll present the results. The first one was on governance, and the hypothesis is frontline workers that work under network governance strategies will have better performance than frontline workers in environments based on other governance strategies. The other hypotheses are related to elements in steering, saying frontline workers who get some discretionary room to fulfill their task perform better than frontline workers with relatively little discretionary room. And then frontline workers who are more in contact, direct contact with their clients, perform better in terms of output than frontline workers who spend more time on other tasks, such as administration and, in general, or accountability. Another one, frontline workers who are relatively willing to use the instrument of sanction have better performance than staff who are less inclined to use this stick. And then we have hypothesis on input and output steering, because I tried to put in what is interesting for economists as well as for sociologists, just for us as social scientists to make a bridge to those economists who do this other type of research, so we can get in contact and real conversation. So those hypotheses are frontline workers in organizations who use standardized profiling instruments perform better than frontline workers that do not use these standardized instruments. And the other ones, frontline workers who are paid Bonuses for bigger output perform better than other frontline workers. And the last one, frontline workers who are steered by output figures perform better than other frontline workers. This is the survey the results are based on. It's a survey in the 2008 in the Netherlands, and it includes public organizations and private organizations. And the private organizations are for-profit as well as not-for-profit. I can talk a lot about this, but it will take too much time, so we won't do that. Here is the first I want to say about the governance strategy. These are the results we had in 1998. We made a factor analysis in order to go for which type of governance strategies we could discern, and we had three types there. One is the procedural network, proceduralists who strongly orient towards rules. The corporate market ones, those are adherents defined more clearly, motivated by targets, plans, costs and prices. And networkers who use brokerage and negotiation and cooperation to get results. And what I want to show you here is that in 1998, the results for the Netherlands were not very clear, because all three strategies have had more or less the same results. But if we look now at the Netherlands in 2008, we see that we have more network than we used to have as a strategy. I talked already a little bit about the other elements we put in and where we had these hypotheses on. I'll come back to that one. I don't have much time. It's just a quarter of an hour. I think I have three minutes left. Okay. So that is why we immediately go to the results of the study. What we did was first, like I said, a factor analysis for some of the explanatory variables. And we made a regression analysis to see what the influence is of all these independent variables we made hypotheses on. And the results are as follows. One, the frontline workers in private agencies give proof of the largest effect. 1% more frontline workers in private agencies results in up to almost 7% more outflow of clients to work. That was the first result. The second big one was on the network linkage. Being employed in a governance structure of network has a relatively large effect on outflow to work. Third one, an important effect for discretionary room for frontline workers to help their client. Another one, to be able to use one's authorities for a flexible and individual-focused approach, in other words, individual pathways to work, based upon the needs of the client, has a positive effect on the outflow to work. And a smaller but still significant effect is present for the time the frontline worker spends directly with his client. As for the criteria input and output steering, which economists use, the results are varying. Output steering turns out to have a significant effect on the outflow to work, but input steering, controlling for other factors, doesn't have a significant effect. And then there are negative significant effects which you can expect, like the composition of the caseload. 1% more clients that are difficult to place results in a 0.25% lower outflow. And surprisingly, the willingness to sanction has a sign in another direction than expected. Though not significant, a greater willingness to use sanctions results in a lower outflow to work. I think these are the first results we have, and the rest will come. I can talk more about this, but I think what we try to do here is, and we'll publish more on that probably in the coming month, but what we want to do is to get a better grip on how to manage frontline workers and to try and make a conversation with other scientists, but also with politicians, based on studies where you can really show what difference different types of steering can make, and proving it with material from the field. Okay, thank you. That's it.
So our final speaker before our discussion is Professor Ludo Stuyven. Am I saying that at all correctly? From Catholic University of Louvain.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this occasion to talk a little bit about a problem that is already fascinating for me during the first half of the 90s. And in the first half of the 90s, it was... the problem that fascinated me already since 15 years ago is about the relationship between public and private actors in the field of employment services. I'm not going to tell you about elements who are in the middle of the policy debate when talking about public-private divisions concerning who will implement employment services. The first element is the effects, the impacts of private providers compared with public providers. That's a very difficult problem. Let us say in general that the impacts of providers in the field of employment services are anyhow rather disappointing, between 10-15 percent net impact. Most of the economic That's the result in most of the econometric studies. Another element that is not the topic for today are the newest adjustments in the arrangements in Australia or in the Netherlands. But what I'm well going to do is I'm going to try to put those changes, those processes, in a broader time frame, a time frame from at least 10 years. I will talk about it on a system level, not on an organization level, and I will focus on processes, not on caseworkers, or not on structures in general. Well, the basic question then for my research is what brought those countries, especially Australia and the Netherlands, so far that they broken up their classic, their traditional public employment service, and that they replaced them in some degree by a privatized system. And this question will be answered in comparison with a contrast case, the Flemish case in Belgium. Belgium is typically a country where people say where nothing changes in this field. Although at the end of the 90s, there was a major plan for reform of the public employment service, also inspired by the developments in the Netherlands, but this plan was not materialized. It was never implemented. So the first question is why in Australia and the Netherlands, and why not in Belgium? And secondly, I've also brought up the question how those arrangements, once put in place in Australia or in the Netherlands, how did they evolve and in which direction? Perhaps this is important. Yeah. Well, this is very concisely formulated, the empirical puzzle between the context, the choice for a certain kind of system, and the outcome of the system. The context that has to do with the macro structural, macro institutional variables. And the first proposition is different context, same choice. And that means that in Australia and the Netherlands, two countries with a very different context, both countries have made comparable choices when restructuring their employment services sector. Otherwise, we see that countries who are more or less the same, the Netherlands and Belgium, that those countries have made different choices. And the second type of propositions has to do with the choices made and the further evolution of that process. And here we see that in Australia and the Netherlands, after a couple of years, both systems tend to diverge instead of converge. And secondly, we see also that in two countries with a very different initial choice concerning their employment services system, Australia and Belgium, notably the region of Flanders, that despite their different initial position, that we have found a couple of elements that point to the same outcome. To resolve this puzzle, I have first of all to introduce the notion of institutional logic, because it's not so easy to look at what changes and when does it change. And therefore it can help to see what is the underlying rationality, the institutional logic of the system, of a marketized system for employment services. Above you see two elements, the system of job brokerage, but that system does not stand on its own. It is interrelated with the benefit side, as stated also by previous speakers. And then I identified a couple of elements. And the first element that is very important is the rule of private players. Once that private players, commercial agencies, are allowed to implement public tasks with public money, then a kind of process is accelerated and pushes towards changes in other elements of the system. And the third element is the separation between the public agency as a purchaser and the public agency as a provider. A third element has to do with financial incentives, and a central element in the new system logic of marketized systems is the focus on management by results and price competition. Also on the benefit side, we have new elements. First element is the element of work first, and also that element forms part of the new logic, because work first has more chance in a system where there is more management by results. And secondly, it is the element of more conditionality of benefits, fulfilling obligations to keep or to receive a benefit. So all these elements are endemic in a new institutional logic. I skip those, and then I come to a model of change to explain those processes of what I have called endogenous change. And what is important here is that the existing structure at a certain moment, the pre-existing structure, is not changed in one fell swoop, but gradually. And that are the different points on the axis, T1, T2, etc. Above, I have mentioned different forms of change. It's not that important at the moment. Let me just focus on two forms. The first forms for process of change can be called layering. And layering, that means that there comes a new institution on top of the pre-existing institution. For example, when we have a system of public employment services, and the government is experimenting with private agencies to fulfill public tasks. That's a form of layering. And then we have another form of change, and that can be called conversion. And conversion, that means that the existing institution is used to serve new goals in a new way. And here we have the result of how on this axis the process of change in Australia can be figured. What is important here is that it's a gradual change. That means that there are several dividing periods. And a first period is the period where from T0 to T1, where there is not a full market system, but a system where we have the mix of both. And that's what we call can call layering. And then we have the second dividing line, and that's when we go from T1 to T2. And that means that the partial system of marketized employment services changes into a full marketized system. We have also the difference between T2 and T3, and that means that after a while, several elements of the system, of the new system, are changing. For example, in Australia, a very important point is the rollover of existing contracts and the new performance measurement system, the star rating system. So that's an example of conversion. What I've also done in this research is identify which mechanisms can explain this process. Because up till now we have described the process, but the second question is how to explain it. And therefore I have found three change mechanisms. A first mechanism has to do with the interaction with the changes in the benefit system. For example, in 2003, we have seen in Australia that the existing benefit system was reversed into the active participation model. And that's important because there was an interaction between both type of changes in the active participation model and changes in the model of the job network, as it is called. Secondly, we have the rule of impacts of effects. And here we come to the question, how important are perceived impacts of the current system? In my view, what is important is how the impacts in the negative or in the positive way are cultivated by the key players in the system. So that's the second mechanism that I have called the cultivation of success or failure of the existing system. And then we have two other change mechanisms, and those mechanisms have to do with the role of actors. And finally, actors are also important. We have also to bring them back into our picture. First of all, we have the politicians and the policy makers, but also the actors in the field, and that's what I've called the anticipatory behavior. Actors are going to behave in relation with what is expected from them. So that's in a nutshell what I've done. Thank you.
So Bill Seitz from the University of Chicago is going to wrap up by giving us some thoughts, sharing some thoughts across these four papers, which ask somewhat different questions, operated at different levels and in different contexts. So good luck.
Well, when I first was given my badge, I assumed the fact that I am privileged with two ribbons entitled me to twice as much time.
Nope.
Yes, of course.
I was quickly disabused of that notion. So I will take what very limited time I have. First of all, just to note my appreciation to Evelyn for inviting me into this very interesting conversation. And also to the panelists themselves, who clearly presented very, I think, careful and sort of attentive to complexity sorts of papers, precisely the sorts of papers it's not possible to do justice to in the kind of sweeping, quick hit sort of discussant style rejoinder that I'm going to engage in right now. Instead, what I'm going to do really is push back at a very general level with what I intend to be a somewhat polemical question. And it is, to what extent are these various cases, which we've been hearing about today, instances of what might be called multiple neoliberalization paths? Or to adapt a phrase from Nick Theodore, who was here earlier, and his colleagues Neil Brenner and Bob Jessup and Jamie Peck, instances of variegated neoliberalization. For purposes of this, as I say, very quick hit sort of response, let me just mention that in this context of employment and labor market regulation, we might define the sort of chief characteristics of neoliberalization as, first of all, a supply-side emphasis, in some cases a supply-side fundamentalism, but in general a supply-side emphasis. And secondly, within that emphasis, a further emphasis on work first. And that the implications, or at least the tendential implications of those emphases, are over the long term an increasing economic dependency on labor markets. Well, let's say, for purposes of argument, that these are cases of variegated neoliberalization. How would we know? I'm going to suggest one possible metric that might be interesting to consider, which would be, what is the extent to which policy failure, neoliberal policy failure, becomes an engine of continued neoliberalization? Now, before I say another word or two about that, I want to flag some caveats that I think pick up some points that were made not only by these panelists, but also Joel Handler's talk earlier. And just to sort of get them out on the table so it's clear what we're talking about and not talking about. Obviously, the European context remains very distinct from the U.S. context on many of these issues in very important ways. There are also clearly very significant differences in activation inclusion policies within these mostly European cases that we've heard today. And this is true not only at the macro level, but also clearly in terms of the dynamics of relationships between street-level workers, larger policies, governance systems, institutional dynamics across public and private sectors, and I think also, as some of the panelists mentioned, not only at the national context, but also locally and interlocally. Certainly also the extent to which social safety nets continue to protect or don't protect individuals, as the case may be, from the brutality of work-first approaches makes for some very important differences that continue to pay heed to. So, a long-winded way of saying, as I think somebody said earlier, there is no convergence. Nevertheless, and here's my question, are there a set of quote-unquote family resemblances among the various logics of continuity and change that are being traced here? My sense, just to put my cards on the table, my sense is that we are in the presence of very powerful norms, hegemonic norms, when neoliberal policy failures, as in so many of the work first failures, become an engine of continued neoliberal experimentation. I would be tempted to use the sort of medieval witch craze analogy, which is, as we all recall, the way that you find out if someone is a witch is you throw them in the river, and if the poor woman drowns, then it proves she's a witch. And if she doesn't drown, it proves that you need more tests. More research would be a way to put it. So I'm going to conclude just by sort of reiterating my points in the form of two questions. One is this an accurate picture of how failure is handled in these various contexts and cases? And secondly, if so, does this constitute variegated neoliberalization? Thank you.
So I think we have about 15 minutes for questions. Zeke?
struck by, especially Fleming, by your discussion of the Danish experience, how much it echoed what's going on in the U.S. And you use the same terminology that we use, work first, which is obviously the code for welfare to work in the United States. So I guess my question, and it obviously it echoes in some of the other presenters. So my question is there some sort of a institutional isomorphism that goes on between the U.S. and Europe? Are these independent developments in Europe, the European emulating the U.S.? It's clearly that the U.S. has not emulated Europe because we started ahead of you in the game. So I wonder if you want to say, any of you want to say something about it, because it's clearly, and I know Joel has spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, but it would be interesting to get it from your perspective. Where do these pressures come from?
Can I answer? Yeah, I try to answer this. I don't know if it's switched on. No, I don't.
I think it does.
Oh, okay, yeah. A very good question. I was wondering the same this morning, actually. I can tell you one story that perhaps could give some clue about what is happening is that I heard the other day that all the executives in the Danish ministry, they were taking their yearly trip to get more educated, and the yearly trip is always going to the U.S. And the last year's trip to the U.S. has been about performance management. So perhaps this light a bit where we get our inspiration from for these kind of developments, but this is of course not the whole explanation for these kind of developments. But I think you raise a very important questions: how to deal with this? Is this a kind of institutional isoform we see here, or what are the reasons behind these similar developments? I think that's really important questions, but I don't have the answer.
Go ahead.
Is it open?
I think it should be on.
Give it a shot. Pull it closer, see if it works.
Yeah. Just to add a remark, we have a PhD student, and she's just done studies on work first in Europe, in the Netherlands, and the UK, and Australia as well. And what you see on a lower level is that there are big differences. Also, Jean-Claude Barbier from France isn't here, but he's always the one who's stressing the difference, the different values that countries give to the same words. And to give an example, for example, work first in the Netherlands, as Rick also knows, we have a very work-oriented work first. And when our PhD student went to the UK, she was very astonished to find out that the work first there entailed coming to the employment office once in 2 weeks, which is a completely different form of activation by work first than we have in the Netherlands, or the work for the dole in Australia. So I think there's more difference than the same word suggests, I think we have to dig a little bit deeper to get really grip on what is happening here, and I of course agree with what you both said, that there are similar developments, but on the level below, especially on implementation level, you see a lot of differences, and also a lot of differences in effect.
A good example is that, for example, in Belgium, where things are not moving, that even in Belgium, the policymakers are using the language of work first, contracting out, and so on. But it has nothing to do with the reality of what is happening in Belgium. So I think that we may not exaggerate the role of policy transfer. There is some transfer, but that process is very, very selective.
Rob?
So I'm going to commit the same selfish crime here twice. This really wasn't planned, but I was thinking very much in line with the discussant's comments here, so I want to kind of bring Bill's comments back into line here. You know, these are interesting questions, though, about, you know, where is the learning taking place here, the U.S. coming from Europe or vice versa. We had a Dr. Midgley here this week talking about conditional cash transfers in the case of Michael Bloomberg of New York City actually going to the Global South to Mexico to study. You know, so I think these patterns of fast policy transfer have certainly been destabilized, right? And so these kind of directional patterns aren't as clear anymore. But on the question here, I mean, I also very much appreciated the empirical richness of all of these papers and had a similar question about, you know, unevenness here we should expect perhaps with the institutionally inherited landscapes, right, that are being called into transformative discourses and processes. But as many of the scholars that Bill cited here, our colleagues in critical geography, have shown that, you know, unevenness should not be just an empirical addendum here, as it has been shown to be in the varieties of capitalism literature, but actually a more virtuous kind of characteristic in regulatory restructure, right? And it's nonetheless, I think the family resemblance comment here has to do with this characterization of a durably patterned variegation, right, or a systematically produced variegation, right, that exploits and intensifies institutional differentiation, right? Nonetheless, by way of some kind of macro steering logic. So maybe a long way of pulling back to this question of what are the implications here for welfare state transformation, right? The kind of empirical richness of all of these papers with respect to this kind of seemingly contradictory dual-prong approach here of variegation that is somehow perhaps steered by macro family resemblances, maybe we could say something as crude as that. And I guess I was thinking of that mostly in Ludo's paper, but it certainly applies to all. So, maybe, Matthias, thanks.
Well, the German case has resulted in the majority of workless people now being subject to a regime that is no longer designed according to Bismarckian insurance principles, because they get a flat rate benefit that is not related to their former earnings. So actually the support for insurance-type schemes of social protection is weakening because it's only a thing for a privileged minority. So in the long run, these kind of reforms bear a tendency of running down the insurance-based kind of social protection, which is, of course, ambivalent. I mean, it's not only a bad thing. I mean, the Bismarckian principles are very exclusive against those who don't have the chance to earn entitlements. But, of course, the question is whether whether the system that develops out of it is more residual or universalistic. And the odds are it's going to be more residual. So there's no question about that this is a neoliberalization, but coming back to your comments, the question is, do we stress neoliberalization, which after we've said that, what else do we say, or do we stress multiple paths? And I would stress multiple paths, because the really interesting question is, if there's going to be a new paradigm in these ages after neoliberalism, then how are the institutional setups in the countries able to respond to that when it comes? So this is the interesting question for the future.
Yeah. I was enjoying that silence where people say, well, what is really the question here? So William Seitz made some provocative statements, and I think you used the word failure, and I wonder what we mean by that. The emphasis on the mechanics and the realities of the mechanics of the various systems may divert our attention from some other aspects of these new developments that are equally important and would get at the question of failure. Because you didn't really say what you meant or one would mean by failure. But it could be that these programs are really quite successful. And they're successful in removing concerns about the social welfare of vulnerable people from public concern. They could be in the case of the U.S., we say there's a consensus that the new system since 1996 has taken welfare off of the political agenda, which is an enormous accomplishment on the part of conservatives. And, in general, one supposes that if one is concerned about vulnerable people in the welfare state environment, the question of popular support for programs of this sort is, over the long run, the most critical question one could ask. So it's not that your papers were assigned the question of where does the welfare state now stand with respect to the polity as a whole, but certainly the intervention of the commentator raises the question as to what success means and whether we have to go beyond, in a sense, the mechanical sense, the mechanical sense of success as getting people into well-paying jobs, and look for the question of social support as these various reforms unravel.
Yeah. I think you raise, for me, a very important question, because I think we are talking, I think it's very problematic that the discussion is always about how these management system function. Are they performing well, or are they performing better? I else raised the question, but until which criteria? I think that's actually the question. Because I think what worries me is that actually there's a democratic problem here, because it's a hidden agenda. Actually, you said it's a success because you could take welfare off the political agenda. And I think that's exactly what's happening when you're doing this, what I call operational reforms. Because if we have raised this as a political debate or put political agenda, it would not have been possible to make these kind of decisions. At least not in the European context. I don't know how it is here in the U.S. context. And I can see, at least in the Danish context, it's impossible to go out political. It would be political suicide to go out and say, now we want to minimize our welfare system. But they actually do because of these systems. So, and that's one part of it. And the other part is this system, it's very, very difficult to see who is politically responsible. That's another problem, because if something goes wrong, who to blame? Is it these new decentralized implementation units, or is it the people who is actually in control centrally? I think that's also makes a democratic problem.
Could I add to that for a second, Julie?
Sure.
I agree with that, and I think also picking up on the the sort of multiplying our senses of failure, what that might mean, and contrarily success, what means political success. I want to suggest, in addition to sort of the kind of potential impacts that these changes have had on the kind of broader political climate and the extent of visibility or non-visibility of the vulnerable. I pick up on a comment I think that Ludo made near the end of his paper on sort of emphasizing actors, and I think it comes through in a lot of the papers and a lot of the micro-level work that people do, the extent to which an important function of many of these programs is they provide work for an enormous array of political actors. In other words, they provide projects, if you will, for policymakers, for evaluators, for interest groups, and these are, you know, from one vantage point, these are groups who are always looking for projects. And it's not just to keep busy, but it, in fact, advances a set of quite particularistic interests that get loaded onto a vehicle, which is an omnibus kind of vehicle, and that does a lot of different kinds of things. And I think that partly accounts for the complexity of what we see, but there's a thread there that I think suggests that the extent to which there is a political success going on here for an array of different actors who are otherwise particularistically divided or fragmented.
Professor Edler has the last question.
My question is provoked by Michael Lipsky's. And it's this. My question is provoked by Michael Lipsky's, and it's this. What does success mean in the context of worldwide recession? Which gives rise to sort of increasing unemployment, not across the board, but certainly in large numbers of areas, large numbers of contexts. What's the function of welfare to work programs when there is no work available for those who use the programs? How should, in that context, the success of those programs be measured?
How should they be measured, or how are they measured?
How should they be measured?
Well, it depends, of course. Sorry.
Go ahead.
It depends, of course, on the point of view of the one that's answering the question. If it's a researcher, a labor market researcher. Looking at the labor market, a type of programming whereby people get more human capital in order to be able to re-enter the labor market later on, that could be an answer. Another answer could be just have them people work more in subsidiary labor, so in the second labor market. For others, politicians, it is a problem to give a nice answer where they can live with, and then there is, maybe that's not an English word, but I always call it a project carousel.
I like it.
Whereby there is always money, but the money is never structural. It's always for one purpose only, and that is the only way the carousel can continue. So that could be an answer too. And what is worrying me is, and it was discussed earlier, it's got to do with advocacy, is that you hear so little about the people that are unemployed themselves right now in Europe. There is so little voice in terms of what could be a proper answer. We have a policy since the 90s in Europe whereby we say people get more individualization and should be approached more on an individual level, and they are more conscious of what they can and can't do. But at this moment, there is no discussion, no platform where these kinds of questions are raised, even political parties. Yeah, we have now some demonstrations in the EU because of the crisis, but they're not directed at especially what we are talking about right now. So I don't really have an answer, but I can give some answers from different angles.
the longer term, I think that what we see in Europe is that it's not only the securing function of a good system of social protection, but also the investing function and the rule of education and training people. And that's one of the reasons why also the European Union is always stressing this element of make people more empowered to survive a crisis or not. That's also an important underlying trend, I think, in the European context.
But I would tend to comment that the hype of this kind of rhetoric is counter-cyclical to reality. They are talking about problems, not about solutions happening.
So I hope actually this last comment and discussion it provoked carries over into the next session. As someone who studies less organizations and more the effects of changes on individuals and how people cope with a labor market that doesn't meet their needs, and increasingly a government that doesn't meet their needs. I think this last discussion is a very important and interesting one. So I want to thank the panelists and the audience for their participation.